Erasing Indigenous Indigeneity in Vancouver by Jean Barman from BC Studies No. 155, Autumn 2007, being read by the author. Canada has become increasingly urban. More and more people choose to live in cities and towns. Under a fifth did so in 1871, according to the first census held after Canada was formed in 1867. Proportion surpassed a third by 1901, was over half by 1951, and reached 80% by 2001. Urbanization has not benefited Canadians in equal measure. The most adversely affected have been Indigenous peoples. Two reasons intersect. First, the reserves confining those deemed to be status Indians are scattered across the country, meaning lives are increasingly isolated from a fairly concentrated urban mainstream. And second, the handful of reserves in more densely populated areas early on became coveted by newcomers who sought to wrest them away by licit or illicit means. Pressure became so great that in 1911 the federal government passed legislation making it possible to do so. This article focuses on the second of these two reasons. The city we know as Vancouver is a relatively late creation. Originating in 1886 as a western terminus of the transcontinental rail line. Until then, Burrard Inlet, on whose south shore Vancouver sits, was home to a handful of newcomers, alongside Squamish and Musqueam peoples who used the area's resources for sustenance. 120 years later, apart from the hidden away Musqueam Reserve, that Indigenous presence has disappeared. This article traces and reflects upon the erasure of Indigenous indigeneity in Vancouver. Persons who were Indigenous to the area and considered it their home long before the arrival of outsiders were first removed from the land they called their own and then saw even their memory deliberately lost from view. Having been unsettled, the Indigenous indigeneity they personified could be erased. Erasure had two purposes. It was an end in itself in the unsettling process whereby, in 1913, residents of Vancouver's most desirable Indian reserve, visible from the city center, were persuaded to leave. Erasure also gave the means for the young city to assert that sense of rootedness that is at the heart of indigeneity without its having to be Indigenous to Vancouver. With the totem poles erected in Stanley Park in 1923, to mark the forced removal of the last of its Indigenous residents, erasure functioned as a pathway to Indigenous indigeneity's replacement by a sanitized indigeneity got from elsewhere. Both forms of erasure serve the dominant society, but in different ways. The first was intended to grow the city by opening up land for newcomer purposes. The second was more invidious, and was intended to create the illusion that Vancouver was Indigenous-friendly, even as it rid itself of the real thing. The first section is entitled, Unsettling Reserve Lands. Of the two means of erasure that occurred in Vancouver, the unsettling of reserve lands was the most straightforward. The emptying of reserves was not a uniquely Vancouver or British Columbian phenomenon. When British Columbia joined Canada in 1871, the charge of the Indians, to use the language of the time, passed to the Dominion government. The Indian Act, passed in 1876, restricted the role of the Department of Indian Affairs to Indigenous people defined as having status by virtue of male descent. To be an Indian was to have an Indian father. The many women with families by newcomer men were left to their own devices, their offspring generally being termed half-breeds, a word almost always derogatory in its connotation. Even though no treaties were signed in British Columbia, unlike elsewhere in Canada, except for small parts of Vancouver Island and the northeast corner across the Rocky Mountains, reserves were nonetheless marked out for status Indians, who were expected to reside there out of sight of the expanding dominant society. The Indian Act provided for Indian agents, who were charged with overseeing both everyday life on reserves and residential schools, which were intended to inculcate newcomer ways into offspring. This centralization of authority in the federal government did not prevent the province of British Columbia from coveting reserve lands for newcomer settlement. By the terms of entry into Confederation, land not legally transferred to individual owners or for reserves remained the property of the provincial government and was known as Crown land. An 1875 agreement with the federal government establishing a joint commission to confirm reserves contained a contentious clause, which had been sought by the province and held that, and I quote, any land taken off a reserve shall revert to the province. In other words, to the extent Indians could be persuaded to unsettle reserves, it was British Columbia that benefited. The country was in a chipper mood. At the time, Richard McBride became premier of British Columbia in 1903. Convinced of the province's reversionary right to reserve lands, McBride pushed for the negotiations that would unsettle the province's two principal urban reserves, located in Victoria and Vancouver, respectively. In doing so, he reflected larger sets of attitudes in the dominant society. Most everyone agreed that Indians who did not use the land set aside for them in ways consistent with newcomers' assumptions had no right to retain it. Urbanization caused reserves in or near cities to be especially coveted. Prime Minister Wilfrid Laurier proclaimed in Parliament in April 1911 that, and I quote, where a reserve is in the vicinity of a growing town, as is the case in several places, it becomes a source of nuisance and an impediment to progress, unquote. A month later, the Indian Act was amended so that the residents of any, and I quote, Indian reserve which adjoins or is situated wholly or partly within an incorporated town or city, having a population of not less than 8,000, end of quote, could be legally removed without their consent if it was in, and I quote again, the interest of the public and the Indians of that band for whose use the reserve is held. 2 years before Vancouver's Kitsilano Reserve was unsettled, and even as the Indian Act was being amended, the Songhees had been displaced in British Columbia's capital city of Victoria. There was no reason for the Songhees to want to move, and in fact, they did not want to do so. In 1890, an official of the Department of Indian Affairs attested that they were, I quote, to a man determined not to vacate the Songhees Reserve, which was land held and occupied by their forefathers from time immemorial and consequently dearer to them than anything they could possess. It was a promise of easy money, backed by Premier McBride's determination and Prime Minister Laurier's consent, that changed minds. The province offered 41 family heads $10,000 each, which was deposit in their names in a bank account, with the bank account being handed over once the family had moved to a new reserve at nearby Esquimalt. By the end of 1911, federal legislation had confirmed the reserve sale to the province. A visitor a couple of years later caught the prevailing sentiment. It was an intolerable state of affairs to see such a large area in such a location lying waste, occupied only by a few Indians. And after much negotiation, it was bought by the city. An unexpected consequence was, to the distress of the dominant society, Songhees, I quote again, seen driving about the city in their own autos. Reserves were also sought elsewhere in British Columbia. Between 1913 and 1916, a Royal Commission on Indian Affairs toured the province with the goal of rectifying complaints to do with reserves. It received a torrent of proposals. Municipality after municipality requested reserve lands for supposedly higher-minded purposes, ranging from public amenities like parks and exhibition grounds to industrial and residential expansion. Among their number, North and West Vancouver officials wanted to possess the Squamish reserves located on the North Shore of Burrard Inlet, and the Fraser Valley communities of Sumas and Chilliwack wanted nearby Stalo reserves. The next section is entitled Unsettling the Kitsilano Reserve. The process by which Indigenous peoples were unsettled in Vancouver was, as in Victoria, the final act in a one-sided drama whereby newcomers claimed the city for themselves, and only for themselves. The Squamish and Musqueam had long used the area's resources. With employment opportunities in sawmills from the 1860s onward, some sites, previously seasonal in their use, became more permanent villages. A map constructed in the 1930s by Vancouver's first archivist, Major J.S. Matthews, based on conversations with elderly Indigenous and non-Indigenous residents about a time still in living memory, showed three dozen what Major Matthews termed Indian names for familiar places, indicating their regular usage. Among locations mapped on the south shore of False Creek, across from the future city center, was Snauk, spelled S-N-A-U-Q, located under today's Burrard Street Bridge. Snauk was the basis of a 37-acre reserve requested in February 1868 by the 42 persons living there under the leadership of Chief Chip Kiam and established the next year. Half a dozen years later, the Joint Dominion Provincial Reserve Commission expanded what became known as the Kitsilano Reserve and sometimes the False Creek Reserve to 80 acres. As well as this reserve located on False Creek, the commission confirmed four other reserves for the Squamish on the north shore of Burrard Inlet in what would become North Vancouver and West Vancouver, and a principal reserve for the Musqueam on the north shore of the Fraser River, an area that would be amalgamated into Vancouver in 1929. Due to the late date of the Musqueam Reserve's emergence into Vancouver's purview and its location on the city periphery, it has remained relatively intact. At the time the reserve commissioners visited the reserve on False Creek in November 1876, 15 men, 15 women, and 12 children were living there under Chief Chip Kiam, whom newcomers called Chief George. The federal government was convinced Indians should become subsistence farmers, so it is not surprising the commissioners' basis for approval had to do with agriculture. They reported optimistically about 8 acres of land partially cleared, although 3/4 acre only cultivated, principally vegetables. They counted 2 horses, 30 fowl, and 7 geese. Residents would later plant a cherry orchard. The Kitsilano Reserve stability is attested by Methodist missionary Charles Tate, who preached at Snauk regularly from 1872 on. Half a century later, he recalled his Sundays there. "They were a hospitable lot, and I was entertained by Chief George and his band in their community house. There was quite a settlement at Chief George's False Creek Reserve, probably a dozen houses, built of split cedar, saw boards and slabs, and the big community house. A total population, perhaps, of 50 persons, all told. It was a settlement of consequence. Old Chief George was a very good, kind person, a fine Indian." The Kitsilano Reserve, also known as the False Creek Reserve and Reserve No. 6, acquired much of its appeal for residents through its access to natural resources. Chief Chip Kiam's great-nephew, August Jack Kitsilano, who lived at Snauk as a child during the 1880s and became a principal informant to Major Matthews, explained how it was not agriculture but the sea that brought the Squamish there, seasonally, in great numbers. According to August Jack, Chief Chip Kiam was the first man to go to Snauk. He built first house close to the water in a tiny clearing framed by the towering forest. The reason for the location was the big sandbar that would later be built up as Granville Island, which is what we know it as today. And now this is August Jack explaining. "The Indians had, from time immemorial, had a fish corral there. Two converging fences of brush in the water, made from hurdles of twisted vine maple, fastened to sharpened stakes, driven in the mud to guide the flounder and smelt into the narrow part where they were trapped." End of quote. Others recall great numbers of salmon, ducks that rose in clouds, and muskrats. The reserve centerpiece was a longhouse made of cedar slabs with an earthen floor. According to August Jack, all around the inside, about 16 inches off the ground, was a bench or platform about 5 feet wide enough for 2 people to sleep side by side on it. A Methodist minister who visited in 1894 described the longhouse as being about 150 feet long, with up to 4 smoke holes in the center of the roof to let the smoke from the large fires, about 3 of them, which probably at that time burned in the center, for there was a regular earth hearth in the middle. By then, the benches along the sides had disappeared, but, to quote the minister, several families were living around smaller fires in the corner or on the sides. August Jack gave himself a naming potlatch there about 1895, and here is August Jack talking. "I gave away about 100 blankets. I buy them at the Hudson's Bay store on Cadover Street, $2 each, double blankets. Besides that, I pay for 80 pounds sack of flour, 30 pounds of tea, and I buy dishes and spoons, give them away down at False Creek in the big long house. The spokesmen say this boy called by white man's name, August. Now they are going to give me my proper name, Indian name, same name my grandfather, Catsolano. Just one day celebration. They come from Squamish, Musqueam, Nanaimo. Typical of British Columbian reserves at the time, the Kitsilano Reserve maintained a relatively steady population of 45 to 60 inhabitants, most of them related through kinship or marriage. August Jack explained how two members of his extended family had houses on one side of the longhouse and two on the other side. Also living there was his stepfather, Chenalsit, or Jericho Charlie, born about 1830, who used his large dugout canoe to freight goods between Hastings Mill, which had been established on the south side of Burrard Inlet in 1865, the small settlement of Gastown to the west, and to logging camps. As well, Chief Chip Kyam's only child and her white husband, who worked as a bull puncher, i.e. he drove oxen, made their home there. As recalled by an arrival of 1882, I quote, John Beatty and his Indian wife lived on the reserve around old Chief George. They had a cabin on the reserve. Initially, the Kitsilano Reserve added a bit of color to newcomers' everyday lives. When the Canadian Governor General, the Marquis of Dufferin, visited the young province in 1876, and his wife expressed a desire to see some Indians in their natural settings, she is said to have been conveyed to False Creek, where she had her hand firmly shaken by an elderly woman remembered as the Virgin Mary. A woman who lived across False Creek recalled how, I quote, in 1891, False Creek was so quiet on a Sunday that we could hear the Indians singing at their services on the reserve as far as our place at English Bay. We used to sit on the shore and listen. Reserve residents could be useful. An English woman who visited the new city of Vancouver with her husband, who was there to hunt big game, told of heralding a canoe from the other side of False Creek. After much calling and whistling, our Indian, William by name, came out of his house, and through my husband Algernon's stocking glass, we saw him packing in all haste, with the assistance of his clutchman, which is a Chinook word for woman. At least he came, and we started. Vancouver's rapid growth changed attitudes. By the turn of the century, it had overtaken Victoria as the province's principal city. Next decade saw the population was then a much smaller place, extending south only as far as 16th Avenue, quadrupling to 100,000. An intricate system of street railways, which sometimes preceded settlement, drew attention to the reserve. So did visual proximity of the city's most exclusive residential area, the West End, with its prized beach on nearby English Bay. August Jack mused about the various houses along the shoreline of the reserve, saying, "You could see them all from English Bay Bathing Beach." Increasingly, as the historian Robert A.J. MacDonald explains, I quote, "The people of Vancouver came to view the False Creek Reserve as critical to the city's continued growth," end of quote. In 1886 and 1902, 10 of the reserve's 80 acres were alienated at the Canadian Pacific Railway to build a trestle bridge across False Creek and in a rail line that was to pass through the reserve. These actions paled before the growing determination to snatch the reserve itself. Several sets of stakeholders or interest groups played a role. The first concerted attempt to acquire the Kitsilano Reserve occurred in the first years of the new century, when, as described in press accounts, prominent businessmen of the city decided to put it to practical use, which was consistent with the self-confident boosterism grounded in real estate speculation that characterized Vancouver during these years. The goal of using the reserve for public exhibition and other purposes for the general good of every citizen became more self-interested the more it was described. The refined plan for a midsummer fair and carnival, complete with railway, tram, and water facilities, was a mildly disguised economic venture wherein businessmen would reap a harvest each year from the throngs that would be visiting. While businessmen were acting in expected ways, a second set of stakeholders might have sided with reserve residents. Legally, the federal government, through the Department of Indian Affairs, was the only body with authority to act, and the sole reason that the Indian agent for the Vancouver region hesitated to accede to businessmen's desires had to do with the value of the reserve land, which he initially pegged at $1,800 an acre, or about $125,000 in total, rather than the $500 an acre or $35,000 that the businessman proposed to pay. A third set of stakeholders, who might also have been sympathetic to the Kitsilano Reserve Squamish residents, was equally comfortable with their removal. According to contemporary accounts, and I quote, "The Roman Catholic clergy, missionaries to the Indians, are somewhat desirous to see the Indians moved away, provided, of course, that the Indians are treated fairly in the transaction." As to the reason, the other Squamish reserves are under close Catholic oversight and were much more strictly regulated according to missionaries' preferences than was the Kitsilano Reserve, which is located on the far side of Burrard Inlet and Falls Creek. According to contemporaries, I quote, "The missionaries look upon the reservation as nothing more or less than a hotbed of drunkenness and situated too close to the city to be a desirable residing place for their charges." A fourth set of stakeholders made its appearance just as victory seemed assured. Vancouver businessmen learned, much to their consternation, that it was necessary that the consent of the Indians interested in the land be obtained. Headlines in Vancouver's newspapers, "Indian Reservation May Be Lost to Vancouver," and "Reservation May Be Ours," underline the full extent to which the reserve's residents had not previously been a consideration. The benign view held that, in comparison with Vancouver's rapidly growing population, there were very few Indians living on this reservation, and that therefore, so far as they were concerned, a better provision could easily be made for them at some place just as convenient. A more critical perspective, which was offered at a public meeting overseen by the mayor, held that the reserve as at present is of no use to anyone and is moreover an eyesore to the city and an easy resort for criminals. Vancouver business interests claimed there were only 11 Indians on the reserve and only about 1.5 acres under cultivation. It soon became clear that this overlooked set of stakeholders had a mind of its own. Like the Songhees with regard to their reserve, the Squamish living on the Kitsilano Reserve under Chief Chip Kiam did not want to leave. Earlier in 1901, they had refused, and now they did so again. The local Indian agent reported on a meeting held there in January 1904. "Chief says that he does not want to sell the land because it belonged to his grandfather. He didn't want to leave this place where he was born, and it's a place where his dead relatives are buried. None of the people in the place want to sell it. The Queen gave him and his people the land." A Victorian newspaper crisply summed up another meeting on the reserve in April 1904. "After a short consultation, the Indians decided they were unanimously opposed to selling or surrendering the reserve or any portion of it for any price or any consideration whatever." Chief Chip Kiam, who had been in charge since at least 1868 when he spearheaded the initial request for the reserve, died 3 years later. And following another abortive attempt in 1908-1909 to wrest the reserve away, events stagnated until early 1913 when a new stakeholder took the lead. About the same time as an American railway company offered $1.5 to $2 million for the reserve, which is sought for a terminal and docks, and the Federal Harbor Commission was eyeing it for much the same purpose, the province stepped in. Even as the Federal Department of Indian Affairs was mulling the offers but putting them on hold until the Commission on Indian Reserves reported, provincial authorities acted. Their justification lay in British Columbia's having reversionary rights to reserve lands. In a transaction culminating in early April 1913, due process played no role, nor was federal approval sought. Vancouver magistrate H.O. Alexander, who was fluent in the trade jargon of Chinook, which almost everyone spoke and all the Squamish understood, acted as intermediary on behalf of the province, and more particular of Attorney General W.J. Bowser, who represented Vancouver in the legislature. According to Alexander's version of events, some reserve residents approached him about a deal similar to that the province had negotiated with the Songhees. He thereupon organized a closed meeting on the reserve in March 1913, at which he read over in Chinook a draft sale agreement that all those present signed, almost all with their marks. In other words, they were illiterate. The amount was far less than the Squamish had anticipated, being $11,250 per family head. or about $220,000 in total. Unlike the Tsangays, they were not allocated a new reserve. The expectation was that they would move to one of the existing Squamish reserves on North Shore Burrard Inlet, or to others located even further north. Before the deal could be finalized, news leaked out of the much larger offers being entertained by federal authorities, which came out to about $50,000 per family head instead of the $11,250. Fearful of the Squamish changing their minds, Attorney General Bowser personally stepped in. According to one of the Squamish present, at a meeting with heads of families held in the magistrate's office, he proffered checks with the following warning. There you are. Here is your check with your name on it for $11,250. Take it. If you do not, you will never get a cent for your reserve. The Squamish refused the checks, one of them explaining, Mr. Bowser and Magistrate Alexander, listen to me. If you own some property and one man came and said he would give you $11,250 for it, and another man came and said he would give you $50,000, which would you take? I think it is best for us to wait a little while until the Indian Land Commissioners are here. At this point, according to this insider account, the Attorney General offered what might be seen as a threat. When the commissioners have gone, you will get nothing at all for your land. Not 1 cent. All you will get will be a portion of land somewhere in the Squamish Valley in return for the Kitsilano Reserve. Now, which do you prefer? $11,250 or nothing. Here's your check. If you want it, you can take it and draw your money for the land, or you can leave it. Before stalking out, the Attorney General told the Squamish, next Tuesday they could have the money in cold hard cash. Take it, or you'll never get a cent. Another report based on first-hand information had provincial government making threats that it would be driven off by the police if they did not consent to sell. A week later, on April 18, 1913, the Squamish capitulated. Natives grinned when they became owners of fat bank accounts, is how Vancouver's principal newspaper summed up the province's victory. Early on a Tuesday morning, Bowser and Alexander met 20 heads of families, including two women, and Uptown Bank, where in order to appease any doubters, $250,000 in gold could be viewed in a vault. Each family head was offered a bank book showing a balance to his account in the Canadian Bank of Commerce of $11,250, exchange for putting his mark to a receipt and thus relinquishing any interest in the Kitsilano Reserve. By the stroke of 12 noon, according to a press account, the last of the band had accepted their bank book. The real and psychological distance that separated the two stakeholders was caught in two events on that fateful day. The first involved, to quote from a newspaper account, a squaw with a baby in her arms who stood waiting for her husband to come out of the manager's office with his bank account. Despite her looking longingly at the comfortable seats in the bank for the use of the customers, no one invited her to sit down, and she took her baby and went and crouched for rest on the hard edge of the base of a marble pillar, whereupon the passing throng looked down on her. About the same time this mother was being relegated to the past, the Attorney General was holding a press conference looking to the future. He proclaimed how, to use his words, this eyesore to the citizens of Vancouver for many years and hinders the development of the city will now make as much profit as possible for the entire province. Later in the same day, he reiterated the dichotomy when he described in virtually the same breath how the Squamish would now be away from the temptations of the city and how this very valuable property should net us $1 million profit. The Attorney General was gleeful over what he termed one of the best real estate transactions ever carried out in this province. The fear expressed in a Vancouver newspaper a week earlier that the sum the provincial government offered was much less than their market value had become a point of pride to the Attorney General even before the Squamish had actually departed. The two worlds could not have been further apart. To ensure no minds were changed and no due process intervened, not only was a big scow at the ready to tow household goods away, but in the pattern established in Victoria, the passbooks were kept by the bank until their holders physically departed the reserve within a promised day or two. Vancouver newspapers had a field day, sending photographers to intrude into every aspect of what was seen as a turning point for the city. Accounts waxed sympathetic, albeit stereotypically, at how many of the young men and some of the older men, too, had been born in the waterfront shanties and had toddled their first Siwash toddles down on the beach when the West End was still a forest. One report described how an old Indian, carrying a roll of blankets, only vaguely comprehended that some great change in his place of abode was happening. At noon on the day of departure, Magistrate Alexander gave $100 in cash to each of the family heads, ensuring that, as a newspaper put it, easy money jingled pleasantly in their pockets. Then, as they physically departed, he and the bank manager handed over the red passbooks, each already containing the $100 withdrawal. Within 2 days, every one of the 20-some families, totaling 60 to 70 people, had been moved out. Majority headed to reserves on the Squamish River in Howe Sound, which they usually went in the summer as part of their seasonal economic round from their homes on False Creek. Having unsettled the reserve, the government burned most of the houses to the ground. The erasure of Indigenous indigeneity from Vancouver was momentous, not just for the men, women, and children who departed. A 90-year-old woman, who at the time was a young bride living on English Bay, still remembered watching the many canoes filled with boxes and baskets pulling away from the beach across the water. In her recollection, the houses they left behind were fired as they pulled away. She told a great-great-niece, who then told me, that the people must have left things behind they could not take in the boats, but everything was ashes before nightfall. It all made her a bit angry and very sad. The deed was done. Indigenous indigeneity was erased from False Creek. One stakeholder, the province, had shortcut the process, bypassing the federal government, who was legally charged with the oversight of Indians. A Victorian newspaper's characterization of the province's action is unjustifiable and immoral. The greatest scandal in the history of the provincial government of British Columbia, and liable to a term in the penitentiary if undertaken by an individual in the community, might have comforted concerned bystanders, that was all. The next days, months, and years saw rancorous name-calling, contention concerning payments being made to non-band members but not to reserve residents who were temporarily away, and arguments between the stakeholders over title to the land, none of which undid the erasure. Apart from a vigorous parliamentary debate over legalities in the transaction, which everyone agreed the reserve had been a blemish on Vancouver that needed to be removed, the federal government, including the Department of Indian Affairs, did nothing apart from the debate to undo an action that clearly infringed upon federal responsibility to the Squamish. Unlike title over the Songhees Reserve in Victoria, title over the reserve on False Creek did long remain in dispute. The Harbour Commission, which had an eye on the reserve prior to provincial action, expropriated the property for development in 1916, which it had the legal authority to do, and held it for a decade before abandoning its interest in it. In 1930, 8 acres were alienated for the present-day Burrard Street Bridge. And in 1934, 4 acres were alienated for the Seaforth Armouries. What was left remained vacant, apart from passing squatters. August Jack lamented how, 2 decades after the Squamish were cajoled off the reserve, cherry trees gone wild there yet, all go to pieces, not look after them. In his words, the orchard went to ruin, fences fall down, and the houses were destroyed. A few hops survived and continued to grow until a building of the Burrard Street Bridge covered them up. August Jack considered it more than a little ironic how I received a formal invitation to be present at the opening of the Great Bridge as a guest of the city. Only in the last decades of the 20th century did the land acquire its present-day appearance. The Squamish, who amalgamated in 1923, except for a minority known as the Burrard Band, argued that for any reserve surrender to be legitimate, all of the Squamish people needed to agree to it. In 1947, the Squamish officially surrendered the Kitsilano Reserve to the federal government, whereupon the province formally conveyed the land to its federal counterpart, which then broke it up into parcels for sale separately. Half of the land became the present-day Vanier Park, containing the Vancouver Maritime Museum, Vancouver Museum and Planetarium. The other 5 parcels were used for private, commercial, and housing developments. The next section is entitled Unsettling Stanley Park. In sharp contrast to the province's illegal but effective erasure of Indigenous indigeneity from the south side of False Creek in 1913, events on the 1,000-acre peninsula on the south shore of Burrard Inlet that would become Stanley Park were longer-lived and more complex. Erasure occurred in 2 stages. The first unsettling was initiated prior to Vancouver's formation in 1886 and the designation of the peninsula as Stanley Park a year later. The principal site in this area, according to Major Matthews' map of Indian names for familiar places, was Huayhuay on the northeast shore. Indigenous people had long made use of Huayhuay, nearby Chethus, and other sites in the peninsula, as is indicated by middens or trash heaps some 8 feet deep and 4 acres in size that were uncovered during road building around the new park in 1888. The Joint Dominion Provincial Commission, charged with marking out reserves, visited Burrard Inlet in November 1876. The commissioners counted 50 persons whom they identified as Squamish in the vicinity of Huayhuay, including August Jack Catsalano's immediate family, but refused to allocate a reserve. The reason had to do with the peninsula having been supposedly set aside as a government reserve prior to British Columbia's joining Canada in 1871. While no documentation has ever been located to indicate that such a reserve was actually officially created, the provincial government took for granted that the peninsula had, as with Crown land, reverted to the province on entry into Confederation. Consistent with this view, a Victoria resident who in 1875 sought to preempt 160 acres of land in the peninsula was informed by the province that several persons had asked for sections of the land and that if disposed of, it would be sold at public auction. In line with this perspective, the commissioner appointed by the BC government, who was personally sympathetic to the request, telegraphed the provincial commissioner of lands and works to ask if the provincial government would allow us to lay off a small reserve at this place, but he received a negative response. The residents of Huayhuay and its vicinity were assured they would not be made to move in a hurry, and they gradually migrated to the other Squamish reserves. The last to live in the peninsula was a woman known as Aunt Sally, sister to two people who were enumerated at Huayhuay in 1876. She had a house and orchard on 2 acres that she fenced off near Huayhuay. By the time Aunt Sally died there in 1923, the name itself had been erased. For the September 1912 visit to Vancouver of the Governor General, the Duke of Connaught, a wooden arch was erected downtown. After he departed, the leftover structure was moved to Huayhuay, which has henceforth been known as Lumberman's Arch. By the time of Aunt Sally's death in 1923, which appeared to conclude the first stage of the erasure of Indigenous indigeneity from Stanley Park, the second stage was underway. It had two components. One centered on legal dispossession, the other a sleight of hand by which a sanitized indigeneity obscured the unsettling erasure of Indigenous indigeneity. The stakeholders in the second stage of erasure shifted from the province to the municipal and federal governments. The two levels joining forces to dispossess Indigenous families who had lived on the peninsula since the early 1860s. The federal government's presence was essential, as it had by now wrested the peninsula away from the province. In 1881, the Canadian government requested the Colonial Office in London to transfer to it all reserves acquired in British Columbia during the colonial period, when the future province belonged to Britain, that no longer needed for military purposes. Despite the British government's being unable to determine that it ever held the peninsula, or indeed most of the other supposed reserves, it eventually decided the best course would return whatever it might once have possessed. Only in 1906 did the federal government assuredly acquire ownership of the peninsula. That year, the Privy Council in London extended a ruling declaring the federal government the owner of nearby Deadman's Island and also of Stanley Park. Assured of its ownership, 2 years later, the federal government gave the city a 99-year renewable lease to Stanley Park. The target for unsettling now was half a dozen families who, since the early 1860s, had lived east of Huayhuay on the north and south shores of Brockton Point. They consisted in the first generation of newcomer men, most of whom had settled down with Squamish wives whose families lived nearby. The women, in effect, invited the newcomer men who they fancied onto their territory. And I should add here that for anyone who is interested, Jean Barman, the reader and the author, have written a book called Stanley Park Secret, which describes this in much more detail. The Indian Act's reliance on paternal descent meant that the wives were denied status as Indians, as were their descendants through the generations. Principle and practice did not necessarily mesh. The Brockton Point families were generally considered to be indigenous, So much so that almost all offspring in the second and third generations were, as a matter of course, whipped off to residential schools, intended for status children. Much as with the chief's daughter on the Kitsilano Reserve, some Brockton Point offspring resided intermittently or permanently on the reserves established for their Squamish cousins on the north shore of Burrard Inlet. But most continued to live at Brockton Point, men longshored on the Vancouver waterfront alongside their Squamish relatives. The racial exception was a white couple who had been invited to settle among the Indians at Brockton Point after the wife nursed one of the Squamish wives back to health. As with the Kitsilano Reserve, so with Brockton Point. The press encouraged Vancouverites to see themselves as distinct from and superior to this indigenous presence in their midst. Acting on a tip, a newspaper sent out an investigative reporter to Brockton Point just a month after the Kitsilano Reserve was emptied in April 1913. And this is the story he wrote. The wayfarer comes upon a group about a dozen unpainted tumble-down shacks and sheds, with one or two cottages in a better state of preservation. On the shore in the vicinity is a jumble of logs and other flotsam and jetsam of the harbor, interspersed with the remains of boats and canoes, fallen into decay with the exception of one or two which are still in use. These shacks are surrounded by a rude fence of palings and present just now an uncouth picture with their moss-grown, ill-made roofs, some roughly shingled, some merely boarded, open in places to the sky, with rusted stovepipes thrust through gaps in the roof in the midst of the flowering fruit trees. Now that Vancouver had a long-term lease to the park, the onus was on the Vancouver Parks Board to protect this jewel in the city's crown. The perception that the Brockton Point families were indigenous caused the board to turn to the Royal Commission on Indian Affairs to remove them, only to inform that they do not come within the scope of the commission. The Federal Department of Indian Affairs was besieged. And here's the letter. On the peninsula which comprises the park, several groups of Indians and half-breeds have small holdings. Then came the reply. Only one is of pure Indian descent, i.e. Aunt Sally. The balance are either half-breeds or whites who are of no particular interest to Indian affairs. It was 4 years later the city of Vancouver managed to persuade the federal government to join in a legal suit to dispossess the families. The federal government's participation was critical and meant that the time period within which the defendants had to prove adverse possession, commonly known as squatter's rights, was raised to 60 years from the 20 required by the city. The long period during which individuals or others taking their places in an unbroken line of succession had to demonstrate continuous residence in order to retain the small plots on which they were living meant that most defense witnesses at the subsequent trial were elderly Squamish men and women who spoke in their own language. Their testimony asserting the family's presence at Brockton Point prior to 1863 did not persuade the judge trying the case, who then had his decision overturned by the B.C. Court of Appeals, which credited the witness. The case went to the Supreme Court of Canada, which accepted the contention of the lawyers for the city and federal government that native Indians have no sense of time, and therefore their testimony could not be credited. The Brockton Point families were unsettled. Those living on the south side of Brockton Point, whose houses were considered to spoil a view of the park from downtown Vancouver and vice versa, were forced out in 1931. Their homes were then burned to erase any indication of their longtime presence on the peninsula. In part because the homes of the extended families living on the north side of Brockton Point were less visible to Vancouver residents, they were permitted to remain. The last family member died in 1958, whereupon all evidence of their longtime presence was similarly obliterated from the park. This final erasure of indigenous indigeneity from Vancouver was not simply an end in itself, as was the case with the Kitsilano Reserve and Hoi Hoi. Rather, it was the impetus for the replacement of indigenous indigeneity with a sanitized indigeneity got from elsewhere. Following the initial decision against the Brockton Point families in the B.C. Supreme Court in 1923, the Vancouver Parks Board put up four Kwakutl totem poles as, and I quote, the first step towards the erection this year of a replica of an Indian village of the British Columbia coast on the cleared space west of Aunt Sally's cottage, which adjoins the Lumberman's Arch. The proposed Indian village at the former Hoi Hoi would be named in honor the Quaggut, or Kwakutl Indians, of northern Vancouver Island. As to the reason for this choice, a Vancouver newspaper pronounced that the Coquille, together with the Haida, who are tucked even further away from Vancouver and the Queen Charlotte Islands, were, quote, the most advanced of all British Columbia Aboriginal peoples in culture. They were distinguished by strong physique and higher mental capacity and a far greater degree of courage and intelligence than the more easygoing and lazy cousins of the South. The Squamish presence at Huayhuay and Brockton Point was overlaid with the material culture of a wholly different people who lived a safe distance away from Vancouver. A few short weeks after the initial victory over Indigenous indigeneity, its counterpoint got from elsewhere was in place. The Parks Board's action was not unique to Vancouver, but rather reflected the enormous popularity during these years of romanticized indigeneity. This is an age when anthropologists, notably Franz Boas among the Coquille, was making the province's Indigenous heritage fashionable in sanitized forms that did not affect the realities of newcomers' everyday lives. The passion to rehabilitate the imaginary Indian who existed prior to the arrival of outsiders was very different from coexisting with real people. While the Indian village never came to fruition, the totem poles, subsequently relocated to Brockton Point, have become the single most popular attraction in Vancouver. For residents and visitors alike, they invite an encounter with indigeneity safely removed from real life. The last section is entitled Reinscribing Indigenous Indigeneity. The story of Indigenous indigeneity in Vancouver was not, however, over. The Kitsilano Reserve was unsettled and the last families removed from Stanley Park, but that is not the end of the story. As with all erasures, however determined and intentional, faint impressions sometimes linger. Some of these faint impressions are relatively easy to re-erase. Such was the case with Huayhuay. The consternation of the Vancouver Parks Board on Aunt Sally's death, her daughter, Mariah Kukalem, who lived in the family house, hired a lawyer to look after her interests. She had every reason to do so. The Parks Board attempted end run a decade earlier to get the Department of Indian Affairs to remove the Brockton Point families had turned attention to Kukalem families' long and interrupted occupation of about 2 acres of land, from which the Department of Indian Affairs failed to see how they could be removed unless they are compensated for giving up any claim to the same. Aunt Sally's daughter began entertaining offers from the property. To the horror of the Vancouver Parks Board, it found itself forced to dicker, and it negotiated a price of $16,500 in the expectation that the federal government would ante up, since it had charge of Indians. Before anything was settled, rumors began floating of a higher offer from a prospective buyer who intended to build a modern apartment house in the middle of Stanley Park. The board chair took the initiative and paid Mariah Kukalem out of his own pocket, being reimbursed a year later by the Canadian government. A symbolic re-erasure followed. Immediately upon taking possession of Aunt Sally's property in late 1925, it was noted in the minutes of the Vancouver Parks Board, the buildings and fences were forthwith destroyed by fire, and later the fruit trees were cut down and destroyed. Robert Cole, a young boy of 10 living with his family at nearby Brockton Point, retained the image in his head all his life. I watched them burn it. The fire department came down and poured gas all over it and lit it up, and away she goes. A second faint lingering impression of Indigenous indigeneity has been relatively easy to tolerate. The Squamish living on the other side of Burrard Inlet and the Musqueam residing in Vancouver's far edge. Also relatively easy to tolerate are newcomers from elsewhere in British Columbia and Canada who migrated to the city during the Great Depression and into the present day. The Ken, much as the historian Carl Thrush describes with regard to Seattle in a book entitled Native Seattle, be alternately dismissed as nuisances or patronized as gifts. Apart from the Musqueam, these groups are landless in Vancouver except as private property owners on a par with newcomers. More recent events have not been nearly so comfortable. Whereas the Indigenous families who made their homes on the peninsula that became Stanley Park remained erased in favor of sanitized indigeneity, deprived even of signage to recall their presence there, the Kitsilano Reserve has reinscribed itself into the consciousness of Vancouver. Their irregular process by which the province unsettled the reserve was never lost on the Squamish people. Initially, it was a matter of money, and no one much minded when in June 2000, the Squamish negotiated a $92,500,000 settlement with the federal government regarding a legal action launched in 1977, almost 25 years earlier, over aspects of the expropriation of the Kitsilano Reserve and a part of a North Vancouver reserve. Then, in August 2002, the Squamish won a court case over the 10 acres of land lying underneath the Burrard Street Bridge that had been expropriated from the reserve by the Canadian Pacific Railway in 1886 and 1902. In the late 1980s, the CPR had attempted to sell the land, which, according to the original agreement, reverted to the Squamish on no longer being used for its designated purpose, and they had successfully sued. The reinscription of Indigenous indigeneity in Vancouver in a 21st century form was initiated in August 2006 when the Squamish announced plans to generate income by erecting 5 or 6 large billboards, each 10 feet by 30 feet, on its reacquired property. The billboards would be visible to everyone traveling over the Burrard Street Bridge, as would other billboards to anyone crossing over the two bridges from Vancouver to North Vancouver and West Vancouver, both of which pass above Squamish reserves. The Squamish explanation to Vancouverites: I don't think a lot of people are even aware there's a reserve in Vancouver that is Squamish Nation's reserve, was an understatement, for such an initiative was completely at odds with civic sensibilities. It was possible, some critics charged, that the plan was a ploy to get concessions in other less sensitive areas that would equally financially benefit the Squamish. The consequence of a potential confrontation over a 21st century version of Indigenous indigeneity: roadways free of billboards, except when passing through an Indian reserve, have become a staple of British Columbia life. In line with this perspective, the number of billboards in Vancouver has shrunk from some 12,000 at one point in time to a handful, mostly in privately owned parking lots. As to the reason, one commentator explained, Vancouver likes to see itself as urbane, organic, green, a global model of sustainability and livability, the anti-Vegas, and the image the city has so successfully crafted for itself does not include big honking commercial billboards at the entrance to major bridges. These types of signs couldn't possibly meet the standards of good taste that have been artificially set in these parts. Negotiations relating to the inscription of indigeneity in Vancouver were ongoing as of late 2007, and also in April 2008 when this article was read. It remains to be seen whether the hasty erasure of Indigenous indigeneity a century earlier has come full circle.